Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Picture the scene. It's Friday night, nearly closing time, in a Super Value in rural County Down. Few people milling about, but quiet enough that the young girl working on the till is scrolling on her phone. I approach and say, "Hiya, do you have any mouse traps?" Now, on reflection, maybe I might have overemphasised the mouse traps because the assistant straightens up and takes a step back so dramatically, I feel like reassuring her that I don't have a live mouse under my coat in the shop right now, but that there might be one in my house about 4 miles away and she is perfectly safe. She says, "No, sorry," returns to TikTok, and my search goes on, an odyssey of about 15 miles in total, to no effect. In terms of things you should love, the mouse should be right up there with bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens. Think Mickey or Minnie Mouse, Angelina Ballerina, and that cute little original Fiat 500 from the 60s named the Topolino or Little Mouse. A cheery little smile, those cute pink ears and delicate whiskers. What's not to love? Well, the adjective associated with them, for one. I mean, while there's something active and heroic about the word canine, and feline feels gentle and sensuous, dare I say, if you want to describe something to do with the world of mouse, it's murine. And having had my fair share of domestic encounters of the murine kind over the last few months, I am sick of them. I should explain, where I live, the back garden opens onto fields where cattle and sheep and lots of other things, including mice, live. So once a year, we'd have a few visitors. This season's started on the most wonderful TV night of the year, the Late Late Toy Show. I watched a few bits of it in the living room and then heard a kind of half gasp, half high-pitched squeal from the kitchen, where my wife had seen a mouse coming out of a tiny gap between cupboards, and she was not planning to return to the kitchen till the mouse was gone. So that's how I found myself on a murine mission amongst the drumlins of County Down on a Friday night in winter. After I tried 3 or 4 regular shops looking for a mouse trap, I gave up and rang a friend who just happened to have 6 he could spare. I took them home, loaded 2 of them up with little soft balls of Mars bar, armed myself with a soft brush, WhatsApped friends a picture of the tiny hole I was watching, and waited and waited. And while the eyes of the country were moistening at the latest emotional TV highlight from the toy show, mine were laser fixed on a gap in the kick plate of the cupboard under the toaster for 3 days and 3 nights. Okay, it wasn't 3 days, but I left my post to have a cup of tea when I stepped back into the kitchen and discovered it was Mars Bar 1, Mouse 0. I sealed up any gaps, left another trap out just er agla na hagla, high-fived myself and went to bed. And that was Mouse Season 2024. Christmas came and went, until one night a few weeks ago, a bunch of us were sitting in the living room, having the crack, firelit, winter's night, and I dived into the utility room to boil the kettle for a cuppa, and I thought I saw a shadow. I had to be sure that's what it was, and it took me 30 minutes of hunting, opening all the cupboards, pulling everything out, searching, loading up a trap again. Came back into the living room where I couldn't really say anybody want a drop of tea. I've a feeling we've got a mouse. But this time, I just went nuclear and called the Mouse Man. Mouse Man arrived promptly in a van, very clearly connected with the rodent business. I'm sure we're still the talk of the cul-de-sac, but needs must and all that. And he set to work. A lovely man, passionate about his job. He even offered to show me a video of a rat one of his traps had just caught in someone's attic, like someone else that I don't know's attic. I politely declined. Now, by this stage, the world and his wife knew about our mice. Somebody said, don't use Mars, try peanut butter, the smooth one, not the crunchy one. And then another friend offered me the charm. Well, of course, I'll take the charm anytime. Aren't we all only a generation away from charms and spells and all that stuff? And you'll try absolutely anything to get rid of the little furry friends. Turns out that he'd worked with this woman who claimed for years that she had the charm for the mice. But she maintained an aura of secrecy in the workplace about this ancient remedy. She wouldn't reveal what the charm was unless you really had a mouse and actually needed it. Totally understandable from a business perspective, even though no money had to change hands, of course. He went back to her when he did have a mouse and he said, I'll maybe try that charm. And she said, now, you might want to get a pen and paper for this. She said, you go into the room where you suspect the mouse might be, you stand silently, and then you say out loud and slowly, mousy, mousy, leave this housey. And you may be laughing, but I haven't seen a mouse in a month.
Save the day.
That means that Mighty Mouse is on the way. Yes, sir, when there is a wrong to right, Mighty Mouse will join the fight. On the sea or on the land.
That red Fiat was to prove a great disappointment to my father. When he and my mother collected it from the garage, the salesman reminded them happily it had come all the way from Italy. Just off the assembly line, he said. It was fiery red in colour and it was to prove volatile in temperament also. My father used to drive us to school in that red Fiat 128. On certain frosty days, as if sick of the cold weather and with the shrug of a diva, it would refuse to start. All muffled up in our winter coats, we'd wait, suspended, in a delicious time warp as my father turned the key in the ignition again and again. We'd hear the dying sputter of the engine, like the death rattle of a weary old nag. And we'd wonder how the day was going to pan out. That recalcitrant combustion engine created a kind of crisis of conscience for us as we weighed up the idea of a day at home by the fire versus a day in the classroom. Soon, after failing to get a geeks out of the engine, my father would go into the house and call my mother. She'd come out, sit in behind the steering wheel and wait for his nod. Knowing the drill, we'd all pile out of the car and take up our positions at the rear. Now put her into neutral, Ina, my father would instruct my mother. Push, he'd tell us, and we'd push for Ireland, shoving alongside him. Slowly the car would begin to move. When we had it facing down the hill, he'd bang on the rear window as a signal to my mother. Put her into first, Ina. That's it. Now, take your foot off the clutch. And we'd stand back breathless, watch it roll silently down the road and wait for the engine to catch. If we were lucky, it would erupt into life. My mother would drive on down to the bottom of the village to warm up the engine and then drive on back up the hill as if by magic. She'd hop out, engine still running. My father would get in and off we'd go at breakneck speed in case the car gave out again. All of us waving through the rear window to our mother. That car caused all sorts of headache, whether it was a dying battery, a faulty alternator, wet plugs or a broken fan belt. When no amount of pushing worked, my father would invoke the revered name of Decky. Over the years he saw a lot of this mechanic and the two men became friends, bonding over their mutual interest in and puzzlement over engines. In time, my father switched cars. In the 80s, he bought a second-hand hatchback Renault 16 with deep-sprung seats covered in beige faux leather. This car had a more robust character. Its girth and heft appealed to my father, and mostly it ran smoothly. When rusty holes began to appear in the floor, he patched them up with contact paper and old HB ice cream posters. This was long before the days of the NCT. The last car my father drove was a Toyota Corolla, and it was his pride and joy. "That's a great car," he'd say. Even when the locks jammed and there was mould growing up along the seams of the chassis, he'd never hear a word said against it. In the end, this loyal car, which had never let him down, sat patiently outside on the tarmac, waiting for him, growing creakier by the month, a bit like himself. Finally, no longer able to drive from place to place, my father had to content himself with the sight of it sitting outside. There it remained for many years, until my father decided to let his youngest take it over. He didn't like parting with those car keys. It was like he was saying goodbye to an old friend. But he knew it was time, and so reluctantly he handed them over to her, knowing he would never drive again.
Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs. Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by, and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry, 'cause I always wanted me one that was long and black.
It was 1988, and I sat in the kitchen with my mother, helping her peel the spuds as I read poetry out loud. This was my mother's way of making sure I did my speech therapy. The rhythm of the words of the poem I was reading, Audre Lorde's Litany for Survival, inspired me, and the ideas motivated me. "When we speak, we fear our words will not be heard or welcomed," she writes. "But when we are silent, we are still afraid. So it is better to speak, remembering we were never meant to survive." As I read, my mind was racing. Agitation and frustration was building inside of me. It was a time when daughters followed in the footsteps of our mothers. The expected future for a traveller bureau of domestic chores and childbearing felt too safe and narrow to me. The world of work and education seemed out of our reach. Outside the trailer, the steady tap of a hammer on copper. My father shaping buckets. Inside, the back window flung open. My sisters dancing to Tracy Chapman on the radio. A song of a revolution. Traveller activism was happening outside in the world. My wings were restless. My parents refused to let me outside the door of our trailer. My sisters pulled me back a few times when I snuck out, hoping to go on a march. But things were changing. New voices were emerging. Critical questions were being asked. Members of my community were finding courage and confidence. The formation of Minker Misley in 1983 marked a crucial shift as we travellers took a more prominent role in combating discrimination and advocating for ourselves. My family lived on the Tala bypass. We witnessed the demonstration against travellers, the chants and the violence. Our family trailer was toppled over. There have been many moments of racism in my life, but that was a defining one. The Tala bypass event sparked a broader conversation about our rights as an ethnic minority. The activism from this period laid the groundwork for future traveller rights campaigning. On January 6, 1983, on a snowy morning, the Dublin Travellers Education and Development Group held their first meeting in a room upstairs on Mead Street in Dublin. John O'Connell, a Columbine priest, and feminist community worker Ronnie Fay greeted everyone. In the weeks that followed, people often got lost because each day the course was in a different building. But a sense of solidarity and empowerment was growing. In 1985, the group found its building, the Free Church, a former Methodist church at 46 North Great Charles Street. Our mission was to advance the human rights of Irish travellers and Roma. In time, it officially became known as Pavey Pine Traveller and Roma Centre. My journey with Pavey started in the early 90s. It was for a woman's event. It was my awakening. A green quilt shaped like a map of Ireland was hanging in the hall. It featured the names and places of families and where we camped. My family name was stitched all over the west of the country. Seeing that traveller iconology made me giddy and emotional. In those days, I could be confused and awkward, with righteous rage occasionally veering into full destructive mode. For me, Pavey Pine was more than a place of work. It seemed to embody my raison d'etre. Deep in my bones, it was a place where over time I was able to stop and reflect, to change and fully become myself. Pavey Pine Traveller and Roma Centre is 40 years old this year. Now younger women walk through those same doors, eyes bright with possibility and potential. I wish Pavey a happy birthday, but I'm overwhelmed with nostalgia. 40 years is both a lifetime and a mere blink of the eye. The memories blur together. Faces, voices, music, laughter, grief, triumphs and failures. There's a satisfaction in knowing we made a difference. An acceptance in realising that change is incremental. It gives me great pleasure to see the young ones who have benefited from our work. The passing of the gauntlet to a younger generation is met with a sense of pride and responsibility. May they find, as I did, a safe space, a sense of purpose, and courage for the fight.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation.
In a shoebox of black and white family photographs, I'm struck by one in particular, of a Palestinian woman standing by the steps leading to the veranda of her home just outside Jerusalem, taken in 1959. Alia is in her early 20s and stands facing the camera, serene and self-possessed, her left hand resting on the roughly cut sandstone wall, onto which an early spring sun casts the shadow of her profile. Her dark hair is swept back under a headband, the glimmer of a smile on her lips. She wears an embroidered blouse, a long skirt, and a cardigan, for it is cold despite the sunshine. She lives with her extended family, the Huranis, in one half of the house. My parents and I live in the other half, which is rented from them, with a small garden presided over by a mulberry tree. I'm 8 years of age. Once a week, early in the morning, Tita, their grandmother, dressed in black, summons me softly from outside. In a sheltered spot by the steps to our veranda, she lights a wood fire over which is placed an iron skillet, like an upturned wok. When the surface is hot, she ladles out some batter, which bubbles and spits before my eyes, forming a giant pancake. The first one she peels off, smears with homemade quince jam, rolls up and delivers to my outstretched hands. The taste is unforgettably delicious, sweet and crunchy. I sit on the steps and eat as she makes the rest, stacking them up on a platter. We do not speak. I'm aware that her own farm has been lost, left behind in what is now the State of Israel, when she and her husband fled the advancing forces in 1948. Now they shelter in her son's house, as she welcomes, with warmth and affection, the young boy from afar who lives under the same roof. As we crisscross this biblical land at weekends, in the now familiar green Chevrolet, I'm alternately excited by the kaleidoscope of sights, sounds, and smells, and disheartened by grim reality. The winding, unpaved road to the Dead Sea passes by the Inn of the Good Samaritan, which I had imagined, from the pages of my illustrated children's Bible, would be bustlingly active, only to find a deserted barn, desolate in the stifling, windless heat. As the road descends to below sea level, we stop and look down a deep gorge, upon whose remote cliffside perches a small church. A wandering cassocked monk engages my parents in conversation and confesses that he has been banished to this lonely, solitary outpost as a punishment for who knows what transgression. Further on, as the road levels on the approach to Jericho, I search in vain for the remnants of the city's walls and the trumpets which brought them down, but find instead a huge refugee camp for Palestinians, many of them young people displaced by the war. White United Nations Relief and Works Agency jeeps buzz around like albino ants, dispensing sacks of food relief, but offering no hope. And yet, standing on the vast ramparts of the Crusader castle of Krak de Chevalier, in the mountains of northern Syria, captured and strengthened by the Knights Hospitallers of St. John in the 13th century, my father's tales of the exploits by Saladin against the infidel Richard the Lionheart fresh in my ears, I can easily imagine fierce warriors charging the enemy on their stallions. The scene is all the more poignant, as the previous evening in an edgy Damascus, I witness with apprehension, from behind the window of our hotel room, Syrian army tanks, their guns alert, rumbling heavily on their tracks through the street below and shaking the furniture. At the ancient, deserted pink sandstone city of Petra, I fall asleep by candlelight in a cave scooped out of the rock face and turned into a children's dorm, with the acrid smell of scorching candle wax in my nostrils. My parents remind me, as they leave for an adjoining cave, to check my shoes for scorpions before putting them on in the morning. On the sand dunes at the yet-to-be-excavated seaport at Caesarea, built by King Herod and named in honor of Augustus Caesar, we camp with friends in bottle-green tents borrowed from UN stores. An Australian pal and I uncover, under a thin film of fine sand, an entire floor of blue mosaic of many hues, lain dormant for well over a millennium. We are delighted with our discovery. Future archaeologists, less so, maybe. One morning, a white jeep with UN markings draws up to the house by the mulberry tree. We are on the move again. I release my menagerie of tortoises and chameleons from the veranda back into the wild. We pass, for the last time, from Jordan into Israel, through the border crossing at the Mandelbaum Gate, and drive north, towards the imposing summit of Mount Hebron. Climbing high, we see remote kibbutzim, which absorbed the farms of displaced Palestinians. A Star of David marks a gap in the barbed wire leading into no man's land, endless miles of desolate, lifeless scrub. Finally, we reach a border post, where a beflagged cedar tree flutters in the breeze. A switchback road through the tree-clad mountains of Lebanon leads us down and down, until, etched onto a sheet of sparkling blue, is the silhouette of a city. Beirut will be my new home from today.
Tony Gregory, a neighbour's child, community activist, socialist, visionary city councillor and TD, died at the age of 61 in January of 2009 after a long battle with cancer. He was part of a network of radical activists, radical artists, and indeed radical dreamers clustered around the northeast inner city with a determination to change the terms of engagement with the state. He won a Dublin Corporation scholarship to O'Connell Schools and he went on to study Irish and history in UCD. And he brought home to his community the schooled understanding of the inequalities systemic in post-colonial Ireland, as well as the lens of his lived experience in his community. He was an independent Dublin City Councillor and he was elected to the Dáil in 1982 and he held the seat for 27 years until his death. He and his comrades in the North Central City Community Action Project, from a rundown office in No. 20 Summerhill Parade, worked indefatigably for his constituents, amongst the poorest in the country, and because Tony held the balance of power, they used it to leverage the famous Gregory deal from Charlie Haughey's unstable Fianna Fáil government of 1982. A deal that promised over £100 million funding for housing, community education, employment and the development of the North Inner City area. Not all the promises were kept, but over 2,000 social houses were built on the back of the deal, and the vision and deep compassion of his politics have been guiding lights for community action ever since. This is my elegy for Tony. In solidarity. In solidarity with the clouds which took the bare look off the sky the day you died, you'll never die. Morning cargo on the wind that smelled of the sea, with the gulls that flocked inland, upriver, stravaging past Liberty Hall, raucous, raucous, raucous in solidarity. In solidarity with the moon, the wolf moon of January, a lamp in the early dark, your last night on this earth. Venus, a diamond, studded the night. Pluto in Capricorn, death drew down the fatal night. With all the planets and stars that lined up to light your path in solidarity. In solidarity with the weather, who will forget the mildness of it, the last days bathed in all that radiant light, mid-winter sun hung in the southern skies, as if stopped still, the solstice burning like a flame for you. With our own lovely star of morning, our seven stars on a field of blue, ploughing a sea of blue, our scarlet banners high-streaked up river, tattered flags of sunset in solidarity. In solidarity with the people bereft by your passing, bearing the ordinary weathers along with their grief, with the passage of time, your name will shine like a star in our private and our public firmaments, banishing darkness, with time itself which brings us to our senses, brings us to our knees, which teaches us humility and our own true natures in solidarity. In solidarity with the foggy dew, the waxy's dargle, the dicey Rileys, the heart of the Rowells, the twang man, and the rocky road that led you down through the songlines of Dublin to the river itself, the seagull raucous Liffey, its smell, its swell, its angelus bells ringing o'er it, its crescent moon above, and the whole world in a state of chazzes in solidarity. In solidarity with those who couldn't organise a piss-up in a brewery, with the one who roared up the knockdown flats, with those who were elected chair and sat there through tedium and tension of meeting after meeting where the soul of the city was fought for and even sometimes won and done on behalf of those who couldn't organise the proverbial in solidarity. In solidarity with the children we have lost and who have yet to be born. Janice, who names the month of your death, looking both ways at once, walking backwards into the future, remembering the future, staring clear-eyed at the past, intuiting the ancient lineaments of the ancestors in the month of the wolf moon in solidarity. In solidarity with your dreams, now that we inherit them, wearing the year of your death like a union badge, wreathed in your dreams of dignity and justice, like a mantle your dreams for the city, for the people, with the people, always with the people, in solidarity. In solidarity with the hair, you were there for it. Elect it now, your totem creature, loping through the sky meadows over Dublin, away off into eternity, leaving the beloved streets, the beloved faces, the beloved songs in solidarity.
Well, in the merry month of May, now from me home I started, left the girls and two were nearly broken hearted, saluted father dear, kissed me darling mother, drank a pint of beer, me grief and tears to smother, then off to reap the corn and leaf where I was born, got a stout black sword, a banished ghost and goblets, a brand new pair of brogues to rock the love of the bogs and frighten all the dogs on the rocky.
Palestine. I came from a nation where old men crawl on hands and knees so I stand tall. A place of sand between your toes, salty smoke in the air, and where children smile with hope against the odds. I came from a people who pick olives for oil and friends for love. A people whose children resist soldiers in the streets and confront tanks with metal, but never forget to kiss the hand of their sido. I came from a house of rubble and dust, held up by cherished memories and with absolute defiance as mortar. A house with cool tiles for summer and warm laughter for winter. I came from a family of heroes, of brethren, and of fading voices across the waves. A family whose story is honoured and whose name will endure. I came from Palestine.
On this morning's programme, we heard Mousy Mousy by John Toll, Car Troubles by Catherine Foley, Happy Birthday Pavi Point was by Rosaline McDonough, read by Kathleen Murphy, Bittersweet by Justin McCarthy, In Solidarity, a poem for Tony Gregory by Paula Meehan, and Palestine, a poem by Durgham Mushtaha. The music was Mighty Mouse by London Music Works, One Piece at a Time by Johnny Cash, Talking About a Revolution by Tracy Chapman, Luli, Shine Like a Pearl by Joseph Tawadros, and The Rocky Road to Dublin, sung by Luke Kelly and the Dubliners. And Paula Meehan's poem, In Solidarity, is included in Dublin, Written in Our Hearts, a new anthology from the Stinging Fly Press, edited by Declan Mead. It's Dublin City Council's choice for the One Dublin, One Book initiative 2025, which encourages people to read a book connected with the capital city every April. Paula Meehan is among the writers taking part in a celebration of the anthology to be held in the Royal Irish Academy of Music on the evening of Tuesday, the 1st of April. hosted by Chris Morash and Aoife Barry. And you can find out more about this free but ticketed event and many other events throughout April at onedublinonebook.ie. That's onedublinonebook.ie. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. You can listen back on the RTE radio app or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.